It is Monday, January the 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. Coming up, what it means when Syrian forces recapture a key town with Iranian and Russian help.
There is this fear that Iran will be very influential and so will be Russia inside Syria. And that's going to disturb the equilibrium.
Also ahead, a TASS suspect arrested in Burkina Faso. Major storm hitting the U.S. East Coast. That's a snowstorm, plus up-and-coming new singer-songwriters. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Syrian forces recaptured the town of Rabia on Sunday, continuing their string of victories over rebels in the northwestern province of Latakia. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Ohio State University Middle East scholar Alam Payan about the significance of all of this. He says it's a very important achievement for President Bashar al-Assad's forces.
Anything that can take some of these cities which are on the supply routes, it's extremely important militarily and also psychologically for the ISIL forces, and also it somehow boosts the morale of the Syrian army and the Kurdish Peshmerga. And also there are some, because Turks are also very much interested in the defeat of the Daesh, or the ISIL, as the Arabs call it, Daesh. So this is an important development. But the fear is that Russians and Iranians are focusing on those groups which are opposed to Bashar al-Assad. Sometimes they are hitting those ISIL positions, but most of their attacks are on non-ISIL forces, which are supported by the United States and the friends of the United States in the region. So there is a fear that probably Iranians will get the upper hand in Syria, and it is going to probably create some problems for Israel, because Israel does not want Iranians to become influential in Syria. So there are some kinds of fears in the region. And also Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and Qatar and Kuwait do not want Hezbollah or the Iranian supported militia to get influence in Syria.
What will Syria look like if the government forces prevail? Will there be a greater Russian and Iranian influence in Syria?
Yes, Syria is the only country where Russia are using a naval base, and also they are using the Syrian airports. In Latakia, for example, most of the Russian planes are flying from inside Syria, refueling there. So that's there will be a tremendous Russian influence, and also if Bashar al-Assad wins and remains in power. So there is this fear that Iran will be very influential and so will be Russia inside Syria. And that's going to disturb the equilibrium which the other Sunni Arab states, such as United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, Jordan, even though Bahrain has the majority of the Shiites, but the government is Sunni. Also, Egypt is a Sunni majority country. So they all feel some sort of uncomfortable that Iran is getting influence and Russia is getting influence in Syria.
What impact will these government victories have on the peace process supposedly going underway in Geneva?
Yeah, that's one thing that on Monday this Stefan de Mistura, which is the UN envoy, he was probably to declare on Monday that there will be some sort of peace conference in Geneva. So probably they are positioning themselves ahead of the United Nations sponsored conference to take as much territory under the control as possible, and also inflict casualties on the ISIL forces. Some estimates are saying that probably 150 to 200 ISIL fighters have been killed, and the success was achieved by Russian heavy Russian bombardment of the ISIL positions. So there is this from the air. The Russian Air Force is bombarding, and on the ground, this is Hezbollah and Iran supported Syrian forces are advancing.
Alon Payen is director of the Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Still ahead, Syria, Islamic State, and terrorism in general on the minds of American voters.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Recent opinion polls show terrorism and national security at the top of U.S. voter concerns just a few days before the first contest for the 2016 presidential election begin in the states of Iowa and New Hampshire. In particular, the war in Syria and countering the so-called Islamic State have been the focus of intense debate among White House contenders from both political parties. Here's VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
The conflict in Syria and the battle against the so-called Islamic State remain major U.S. foreign policy challenges. And some sharp differences have emerged in the debates among those seeking the White House this year. Republican frontrunner Donald Trump has vowed to destroy Islamic State jihadists as a key step in keeping the U.S. safe from terrorist attack.
We need a toughness. We need strength. We're not respected as a nation anymore. We don't have that level of respect that we need. And if we don't get it back fast, we're just going to go weaker, weaker, and just disintegrate. We can't allow that to happen.
Trump's main rival, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, favors airstrikes.
Right now, Obama is launching between 15 and 30 air attacks a day. It is photo op foreign policy. We need to use overwhelming air power. We need to be arming the Kurds. We need to be fighting and killing ISIS where they are.
But Florida Senator Marco Rubio argues the key is an international ground force.
Airstrikes are a key component of defeating them, but they must be defeated on the ground by a ground force. And that ground force must be primarily made up of Sunni Arabs themselves.
Rubio also favors regime change in Syria, while Cruz and fellow Republican contender Rand Paul do not. In the Democratic contest, frontrunner Hillary Clinton also favors an aggressive military campaign against Islamic State fighters, but one that avoids using large numbers of U.S. troops.
They want American troops back in the Middle East. They want American soldiers on the ground fighting them, giving them many more targets and giving them a great recruiting opportunity.
Her main challenger, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, disagrees with Clinton over the need for regime change in Syria.
It is not Assad who was attacking the United States. It is ISIS. And ISIS is attacking France and attacking Russian airliners. The major priority right now in terms of our foreign and military policy should be the destruction of ISIS.
Concerns over terrorism in particular will play a dominant role in the campaign, says John Fortier.
When it comes to terrorism, where they think it could come to America, when they see ISIS beheading Americans or the attacks in Paris or in San Bernardino, then it becomes a more real issue, and I think that's what some Republicans are seizing on.
In recent polls, voters rate terrorism and national security their top concern over the traditional top issue, the economy. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And you can keep up to date on what's happening on the U.S. political scene at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Burkinabe government announced Sunday that it had arrested several members of the dissolved presidential guard for their alleged involvement in Friday's attack on an armory in the capital, Ouagadougou. The country is still grappling with the aftermath of an attack on a hotel and restaurant earlier this month claimed by the Islamist militants that left 30 dead. Authorities had already arrested 11 members of the disbanded presidential guard after the Friday raid. Thousands of trainee teachers took to the streets of the Moroccan capital Rabat on Sunday, protesting government plans to cut education jobs. Representatives of the five major trade unions and youth activists marched to the education ministry as well as to parliament. Protests are one of several rallies in the last few months against government plans to cut spending and reduce public sector hiring aimed at improving state finances. Chad had set its presidential election date for April the 10th. The incumbent, Idriss Deby, is in power since 1990, expected to seek re-election when his ruling Patriotic Salvation Movement Party meets next month. Three other candidates have announced that their intention to run, including former Prime Minister Kassir Kumbakoye. The government declared a state of emergency, you might remember, in November following several attacks by the Sunni militant group Boko Haram. The Impala Platinum Company in South Africa announced Sunday that four miners have been killed. It happened as a result of an underground fire at the Rustenburg mine, about 120 kilometers from Johannesburg. Miners are said to have been overcome by fumes as they tried to escape the fire, which broke out on Friday. A new survey by the South Africa-based group Afrobarometer shows poverty levels have dropped in 22 of 33 African countries surveyed. Robert Mattis is senior advisor to the group as well as professor of political science at the University of Cape Town. He tells VOA's William Eagle several factors influence poverty, including the amount of support given to health, education, and development.
We also find that where states build development infrastructure, people do much better. What we've done is in each community when we do the interviews, so our interviewers will do eight interviews with, our field workers do eight interviews with randomly chosen respondents in a census enumerated area that's been randomly chosen. And while that's going on, the field supervisor will go around the area and visually observe or ask about the presence of certain services. So do they see a paved road? Is there a sewage network? Is there electricity grid that most people can access? Is there piped water, et cetera? And we're in those sampling areas that have things, that have a paved road, have sewage, have electric grid, have piped water system. They have a health clinic within walking distance. People who live in those areas experience these shortages, experience the poverty far less frequently than the people who live in areas that have not had these services built.
You found that in North Africa, many governments that are authoritarian spent more on education and infrastructure, social services, compared to sub-Saharan Africa. But you also cite some impressive strides in Africa among democracies like South Africa, Zambia, Cape Verde, and Ghana.
You know, you correctly mentioned that Zambia, Ghana, and Cape Verde are the three places. I mean, Cabo Verde also has received a lot of credit from the Millennium Challenge account and from other international sources in terms of its ability to, you know, through good governance to wisely put into effect the kind of funds it's received from various donors. And those are the only three countries we have that our data going back to 2002 show a long-time consistent trend in falling poverty. There are Senegal, Namibia, and South Africa that we see more recent decreases going back to about 2008. But in all those countries, poverty had actually increased in the previous about 6 years, and then they have fallen since then. South Africa is one of those countries where poverty has fallen more recently. I mean, I think still South Africa has had to deal with a long-term employment crisis, which is, I think, especially acute for an industrialized society. But it also had the very severe HIV/AIDS epidemic. But I think, you know, now we see the cumulative effect of a very expansive social welfare network which has been put in place by the government. We are not clear how long it's going to be sustained. That it's really pushing the edges of the envelope in terms of budgetary stability. But South Africa now has one of the largest numbers of people in the world, not just in the developing world, but who are receive some form of social welfare grants from government, and that seems to be now one of the factors, along with just the ability that the government keeps every year building more houses, building more clinics, electrifying more townships, and doing those kind of basic things that we find to be the chief drivers of poverty alleviation.
Robert Mattis is a senior advisor to Afrobarometer as well as a professor of political science at the University of Cape Town. He was speaking with VOA's William Eagle. You know, it'll be days before life returns to normal, if it ever does, along the U.S. East Coast after a massive winter storm brought some blizzards, flooding, record-shattering snowfalls to tens of millions of people. U.S. government is closed today for all but emergency employees as Washington is digging out and recovering from one of the largest snowstorms to ever hit the nation's capital. We asked Jack Boston, senior meteorologist at AccuWeather, if this was a historic blizzard.
Absolutely a historic blizzard. In New York City, for example, at Central Park, only missed the all-time record for one storm by a tenth of an inch. Well, actually, that would be 2 centimeters. But anyway, the total snowfall in New York City was 68 centimeters. The old record 70, or the record is 70 centimeters. So they just... Central Park just missed it. That's why you would call it a historic blizzard.
Absolutely, as is the metric system. We also asked him how the snowstorm came about.
We have a storm system that formed near the Gulf of Mexico. And whenever a storm system forms that far south, it has a lot of moisture with it when it comes northeast. At the same time, we had an Arctic high-pressure system supplying the cold air, which lay from the St. Lawrence Valley of Canada all the way back to the Great Lakes into the Central Plains. That supplied the cold air, and the storm system itself, which intensified rapidly on its way east-northeast, supplied the moisture.
And let me tell you, there was some moisture out there, and no one knows it better than my colleague Jim Stevenson, who walked through the deep snow to get to work today. And then there's Michael Lippin, who has a special reason for being an expert on snow.
The sound of snowball fighting. A lot of people from Washington to New York are enjoying a huge snowfall that arrived Friday and Saturday. And, of course, it included those snowball fights, of which our own Michael Lippin is quite familiar with. Michael, hello.
Hi, Jim. I'm familiar because I actually organized these things.
We'll blame you. It's pretty exciting, though. A big turnout today.
We did, yeah. I organized the snowball fight of the Washington, D.C. Snowball Fight Association. It's a thing. It's a Facebook page. And we had hundreds of people turn out to DuPont Circle Park, which is one of the really popular parks in northwest Washington. And not only do we have lots of cheers and yells and screams, we even had a DJ playing.
All right, we are here with Julius Snell, also known as DJ Chosh, right?
Yeah, DJ Chosh.
You brought the music again.
Yeah, it's fun.
Thanks so much for doing this, man.
Yeah, I need to come down here.
All right, so tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm just having a party here in D.C. right now. Walked down from Adams Morgan. I'm going to DJ at the Dew Drop-In on Friday the 29th. So come down to Brooklyn if you're around.
All right, and then this is what we got going on right here. All right, Julius, thanks so much for bringing the music again for the second year in a row. Thanks a lot. Okay.
So much fun, Jim.
Well, this really illustrates the power of social media, though, Michael, because you've organized this online and so many people got together because of what was posted.
Exactly, yeah. You know, we use Facebook to mobilize these kinds of get-togethers for snowball fights. We have this Facebook page called the DCSFA, the DC Snowball Fight Association, and then we create an event through that page. And, you know, when you time that event with a big snowfall, people just gravitate to that so quickly. It spreads like wildfire because people will tag their friends. They'll say they'll invite their friends. And we had something like 3,000 RSVPs to this event today. About, maybe 500 people or so turned out because there was no Metro underground train service today. So people really had to walk there.
That's still a lot of people out in the major snow. Many thanks to you, Michael. International Edition's Michael Lippin. You can find Michael on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. Jim Stevenson is there as well at VOA Stevenson. And in fact, I'm there. You can't miss me, VOA Norman. Plus, International Edition's Twitter handle is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Canadian researchers have found that nonverbal human sounds of emotion, such as a scream of anger or alarm, a cry of sadness, or a laugh of joy, are able to better communicate feelings than spoken words. Writing in a study published by the journal Biological Psychology, the scientists from Montreal's McGill University also discovered that our brains respond in just 1/10 of a second to these non-spoken vocalizations. They say our ability to quickly recognize the non-spoken sounds of emotion was a matter of human survival long before language was developed. Working with 24 research subjects, the scientists found that sounds of happiness, like laughter, registered quicker with the volunteers than sounds of sadness or anger. But angry sounds and speech produced longer-lasting brain activity in their subjects' brains than either happiness or sadness. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, those in the know say 2015 was a great year for music, with many new groups and individual singers, songwriters out there creating all kinds of hits. Well, right now, we're going to find out about three new stars on the music scene expected to make a big splash this year. And raised in the U.S. city of Phoenix, Arizona, and now singer-songwriter Casey Hill is making music on Conway West's Good Music label. Casey Hill worked as a model and then a dancer for one of Kanye West's tours before recording music as an alternative rhythm and blues artist with such hits as Arm's Length. Born in the British county of West Sussex, singer-songwriter Tom O'Dell always knew he wanted to do what his idols did. Big into Elton John, Leonard Cohen, and Bob Dylan, O'Dell's songs have been described as emotional and raw.
I wanna take you somewhere, so you know I care, but it's so cold and I don't know where. I brought you daffodils on a pretty string, but they won't flower like they did last spring. And I wanna kiss you, make you feel alright. I'm just so tired to share my nights. I wanna cry and I wanna love, but all my tears have been used up on another love, all my tears have been used up on another love, all my tears have been used all on another love, all my tears have been used all.
And then there's Dua Lipa. Born in Kosovo, now living in London, her singer-songwriter skills have pushed her to the top of the downloads charts with such hits as Be the One.
I
I see the moon. Oh, when you're looking at the sun. Not a fool. No, you're not fooling anyone.
Dua Lipa sings what's known as Cosmo Pop, somewhere between pure pop and R&B.
Come back to me, baby, we can work this out. Oh, baby, come on, let me get to know you. Just another chance so that I can show that I won't let you down enough. No, I won't let you down enough.
Casey Hill, Tom Odell, and Dua Lipa are on just about every music critic's watch list to become big stars. And 2016 just might be the year that happens. You know, half the time I see things in both blue and red. I guess I see it in purple, maybe, huh? Listen, thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Very good to have you with us. The latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now, a bit more of Dua Lipa's Be the One.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply alarmed by reports, including those from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, of serious human rights violations and abuses in Burundi, including eyewitness reports of mass graves, a sharp increase in alleged enforced disappearances and torture, and reports of sexual violence by security forces. U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner said these and other reports further underscore the urgent need for the government of Burundi to allow for the immediate full deployment and unimpeded access of African Union human rights observers to investigate these allegations. It is imperative that the government of Burundi remove all bureaucratic and practical roadblocks it has used to prevent the AU human rights and military observers from fulfilling their mandate for the past 6 months to investigate reports of violence committed by any side in the conflict. The United States, said Mr. Toner, calls upon the government of Burundi to permit an immediate, impartial investigation into these recent allegations and to hold accountable all those found responsible for crimes. The United States remains concerned about Burundi's ongoing political and humanitarian crisis and the resulting suffering it has brought to the people of Burundi. We once again call on all parties to reject unlawful violence and reiterate that the only way to resolve the crisis gripping the country is for all parties to agree promptly to engage in internationally mediated, inclusive dialogue without preconditions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.